Welcome to Train Time, a podcast from the Train Campaign, working to connect cities and rural areas because we're convinced that passenger rail is the essential framework for efficient, sustainable transportation in the 21st century. Train Time is hosted by Karen Christensen, founder and president of the Train Campaign.
Party boys, is that the chimney be choo-choo?
Welcome to Train Time. I'm Karen Christensen, and we're talking today with Jim Matthews, CEO of the National Rail Passengers Association, about innovative ways of looking at the value of passenger rail to our country and to our communities. Jim, welcome to Train Time. It's really a pleasure to have you with us today.
Oh, not at all. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's just amazing to be able to talk. I remember when we first met in Albany, the first and only time we met right before all the lockdowns.
Indeed. It's hard to realize that it was only, February when that happened, right? I mean, it seems like a thousand centuries ago in some ways.
Yeah, and I'm grateful to have the time. You know, I know that you in Washington are exceedingly busy with a lot of stuff to do with ensuring that our rail systems continue to stay active and available to people across the country. But today we're going to focus on something that I think has really long-term implications. When we're post-COVID-19, this will be every bit as relevant, which is the way we approach systems, building systems that will support economic development, social equity. And you and I talked about that a little bit in Albany, and it's coming up now in Massachusetts in connection with the East-West Rail Project. But this is something that you've devoted a lot of time to thinking about. Can you tell, how did you start looking at the systems aspect of rail?
I guess in some ways I always looked at it that way, but didn't necessarily have the tools or the vocabulary to communicate it. I've been riding trains since I was 8 years old, and it always seemed to me that it was not about the train, the hardware, but about the people and the communities that are connected. That just seemed intuitive to me. And as I got older and became involved in rail advocacy, it was very clear that we all know the rail corridors generate value by acting as economic engines in the communities they serve. Through jobs, retail, mobility, tourism, real estate development. We see it. You can see it with your own eyes as you roll into stations where the communities are thriving because of that service. And we all say that as advocates and have said it for years, but we really didn't have a good way until recently of really demonstrating that in a compelling way, other than telling people to go visit places like Denver Union Station or the Amtrak station in Meridian, Mississippi, or some of the stations along the route of Amtrak's Down Easter between Maine and Boston. When you go and you see it, you think, oh, well, of course. But that's different from being able to describe it and quantify it and really have a detailed conversation about it. And so I decided once I became the CEO of the association in late 2014, one of the things I wanted us to do was to find a way to move from anecdote to data. It was important to me that we be able to back up our assertion, which we can certainly demonstrate through, visits to stations or whatever. I wanted us to be able to have a compelling conversation with data, be able to say, not only, yes, it's an economic engine in the community served, but this is what that engine produces. This is what we should consider the profit of Amtrak. The profit doesn't go to the railroad. It goes to the communities served.
Aha, you've brought this up a lot. And I know I've heard you speak on the subject before. You want to sum that up for listeners about the cost of Amtrak?
Sure. I think one of the criticisms of Amtrak persistently over the years has been that Amtrak loses money. And you'll hear this over and over. Amtrak loses money. It's a money-losing company. And you'll particularly hear it with some of the trains that are off of the Northeast Corridor. You'll hear the money-losing long-distance routes. And so it's repeated. It's a drumbeat. But if you look at what Amtrak is for, Amtrak exists to provide vital service to communities where the private sector cannot profitably afford to provide it. And the profit goes to the communities served, often to the tune of billions of dollars a year. It's not Amtrak's profit, it's the community's profit, and it's the taxpayers' return on equity for that investment made in Amtrak and public transportation over the years.
I think this is such an important point that I think all of us rail advocates need to talk about more to help people understand it, because otherwise we just are not approaching any of these infrastructure projects in the right way. And I think that this is not, you know, people don't talk about roads that way. Nobody says, well, what profit am I getting from these roads?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, we will spend on average in the United States $70 million a mile building highways, and no one blinks an eye. No one stops to even ask the question. And yet, when we start looking at rail investment, the very first question is, well, is that going to be profitable? And we get really zeroed in on what's called fare box recovery, this idea that you're going to collect fares that will equal or more than equal what it costs you to run the train. And that's really not correct. It's not the right way to view it.
Yeah.
Because there's not a single transportation mode on the planet that is 100% self-sufficient.
Right. That's just not how they work. That's not what they're for. And that's why I was so glad to have a chance to talk to you, because this is something that we need to help, you know, to shape the conversation on, especially when it comes to a forthcoming infrastructure investment or stimulus bills. These are the kind of issues that are going to come up, and your voice in Washington is important, but we all need to be speaking within our states as well.
Agreed. I think that when I look at one of the things I'm most proud of with the economic benefits model that we developed is that we have the ability to look at routes. We can look at individual states. We can even look at individual communities. And so we really can, with a little bit of time, assess what the value of these investments will be to a given community that is served by rail. And too often we haven't done that. I think, you know, we again get zeroed in on the idea of, well, it costs me, say, $50 million a year to run this train, and I collect $38 million in fares, so it loses money. Well, there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah.
And you know, if you start to tease it apart, it becomes apparent why that would be. And a lot of the sort of public cost benefit models don't take these other factors into account. But let's stop and think about it for a minute. It, when you do, it makes perfect sense. The train doesn't just operate like a big model train set. There are people on those trains, right? They are going from a place and to a place, and when they get off in that place, they bring their wallets and their purses with them. So whether you're traveling for vacation or personal reasons or business or students or whatever it is, visitors spend money at their destinations. They pay for hotels. They pay for lodging. They go to restaurants. They shop. They go to bars. They buy things. And when they do that, they support the hotel workers, the restaurant waiters, the cooks, the people in the stores, the retail, the entertainment outlets. And when they do that, they generate sales tax revenues for the communities that they visit. And the local workers who are at the other end of that transaction, they too contribute to the local tax base, further spreading that economic benefit. And they would not be there to do that if the service didn't exist. Meanwhile, because all those visitors have left their cars behind because they're on the train, they're not imposing wear and tear on highways and roads. And that costs money too. They're avoiding the risk and cost of injuries or even death from car crashes. But again, just look at one of the single biggest expense that a lot of small towns and even counties face is road maintenance and highway maintenance. It's very expensive.
Yes.
You know, we get focused on what it costs to build a highway, and nobody stops to think about what it costs to keep the highway functioning. And you can't drive 10 miles in this country without finding a road project, a maintenance project underway. Right? It's just true. And that costs money. And so when you take cars off the road, you reduce the need for that maintenance. So all of those factors together help to produce a benefit. And right now, our association estimates that the existence of Amtrak nationwide probably contributes between $7 and $8 billion a year to the nation's economy through all of those factors. And we spend very roughly $1.9 billion a year to have an Amtrak. Uh-huh. So that's a pretty good return.
It's a fine return. So how do you gather, or how would one gather the data that for, because in a lot of parts of the country, there are regional rail projects. Certainly this is true in Massachusetts, but I know you've talked to me, I think about the Midwest and I think the Southeast, about some of the rail networks you've looked at. How do you go from anecdote to data on these things?
Well, our process, our model is built around the ridership and the known tourist data that goes with a particular community, as well as known factors around mode shift. In other words, we know that when there's service available in a particular area, a known percentage of people will turn from driving, for example, to take the train. That's been demonstrated. So we fold all of that together, and we start with a ridership, and then look at the ridership and what that ridership generates in a given community, and we again we look at those factors. We know generally, at least on a state level, and very often in a community level, what the average visitor spends on lodging or restaurants or shopping. And we figure that in. And we use the ridership figure to calculate that. And then having done that, we then look at, we run another section of the model, which accounts for county level taxes, real estate effects, induced labor. So jobs that are created by the existence of other jobs. And this is drawn very heavily from the U.S. Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics databases. So you fold all of that together to get a picture of people coming in and out, a count of people coming in and out, and then assuming that when they get there, they will spend some fraction of their money on these activities while they're there. And we also know that if a particular traveler has traveled 500 miles to get off at a station, well, then that's 500 miles that they did not drive. So we remove 500 miles from the vehicle miles traveled times the number of riders that we have. And so all of those things, again, add up to reduced wear and tear on the highways, reduced risk of accidents, and so forth. So that's kind of the way we approach it.
And then how do you build out a network model? I believe you showed me a map, or perhaps you, in your presentation that I saw in Albany, you know, about how you think, well, what if you connect this this cluster of cities with that cluster of cities so that people can not just move north and south, they can move east and west or whatever it might be.
So that's an important factor. You know, the network effect is real, and it helps to make a compelling financial case for rail service. I think too often we have looked at individual communities or looked at existing routes, and it makes a lot of sense to start to look at the data that are out there in publicly available on the trips that take place between cities or metropolitan areas.
Yes, yes.
We know how many there are. Those statistics are widely available. And you start looking at, okay, so who travels from this location to that location? How many people do that? And over the past 5 years, have more people started going to this subsidiary place rather than the main place? As you start to look at those flows of people in the data, it's almost like when you go to a public park or maybe a college campus and you see all those paths that are worn down in the dirt from people not taking the sidewalk.
Yes.
Because they know just intuitively that this is the best way to get there. And even if they haven't built that path, I'm going to walk that way. And hundreds of people collectively making that decision wear down that little grass path in the park. And looking at the network data is a way of looking at the same thing. Where are people going to? Where are they coming from? And what is changing? And when you do that, you can start to see where the investments would make sense and how, if I put these five metropolitan statistical areas together, the economics maybe don't quite work. But if I add this sixth community, because two of those intermediate pairs really want to go to that sixth community, now I can string those six together and all of a sudden, hey, that's a compelling model. That's enough people going among those six places that it changes the conversation about whether and how to do it.
Yeah, and I think that post-pandemic, because we see some shifts in working patterns, that I assume that we're going to want to start doing calculations about people relocating, people working differently, and obviously having trains available enables people to have more choices about where they live or how they organize their working life too.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that I'm not in the camp of people that believe that we have seen the end of commuting as we know it. I think that's premature.
Yeah.
But certainly the patterns of travel are going to change. And so as we start to see how that changes, we can see whether it actually makes sense to make additional investments on, for example, corridors that may already be in place. We may find that there are places that had relatively light ridership where all of a sudden folks are discovering, hey, this is a good place to be during this changed time, and maybe I'll start traveling there instead.
That's certainly what we're finding in Massachusetts, because there are places, plenty of places in Massachusetts where you can easily commute, or especially if you had good rail service, to Boston or New York or Albany.
I think so. I think so. I do think, though, that again, we started to see this particularly sort of in April and May, as the pandemic really started to emerge as a long-term phenomenon. We saw a lot of people declare that, you know, we're all going to work from home from now on. I just can't accept that for lots of reasons. I mean, number one, if you look at the so-called knowledge workers, only 38% of the American workforce could be classified as a knowledge worker. Whether you're building a barn or an office tower or a business relationship, remote control is only going to go so far. Not everyone is a knowledge worker. Not all business relationships can be grown and nurtured and expanded while sitting in front of a screen while your kids or your pets are fooling around behind you, or in some cases in front of you. So even for those knowledge workers, you know, telepresence can be kind of an incomplete substitute for some kinds of workplace interaction. Building things, delivering hands-on patient care. There's so many tasks that require humans to be face-to-face. I think that it is, we will, the pattern of our mobility will change, but I think humans want to move around and want to see each other. And that's going to be true regardless.
They do. And in fact, there's all kinds of, in terms of sustainability, we want, in some cases, we want to have people more concentrated. In terms of innovation, a lot innovation really does, you know, this is why places like the Silicon Valley or Boston or Austin, you know, they, because you have people together and they're talking, and it isn't the same online. But I think that people are going to seem to be finding a bit more balance, and that can, you know, that can be very positive. But it actually requires better rail service to make that possible.
It does. I completely agree. People need the freedom to travel in different ways at different times and in different places without jumping in a car.
Yeah. So we're going to be very interested in following your work, obviously, in terms of you know, the work you're doing in Washington with the federal government, but also in terms of really thinking about the models that will help people in different parts of the country respond to a changing world in the next few years, and in, you know, really thinking about the future. Really appreciate your leadership on this, Jim.
Thank you so very much. I really do think this is an important topic, and it is one that is overlooked. And I just hope that people begin to see the benefits of scale, the benefits of interconnectivity, and the way that it sort of ripples out and makes everyone's lives better, even those who aren't necessarily riding the train.
Train Time Podcast is brought to you by the Train Campaign, sharing a vision for passenger rail as the essential framework for efficient, sustainable transportation in the 21st century. Learn more at traincampaign.org.